Today, we're moving away from the theory and getting into the practice. We have tended to use the word incarnation only in connection with Jesus, the Word of God incarnate. But there is a sense in which I believe all faith has to be incarnated, has to be made flesh, has to be given practical expression so that people can see it and feel it and touch it. Because faith is not an idea, it's a way of life. So tonight I want to look not at how the Methodists found their faith or what the theory of that faith is, but I want to look at how they practiced it. And I want to look at it under three headings of worship, administration, and community concern. How did the early Methodists worship? I think the most widespread heresy in every church is the one that believes that as things are now, so they always were. And that in the church, nothing ever changes. Believe you me, nothing ever stops changing. The life of the church evolves in response to the community and in response to the circumstances in which the church lives. The gospel is the same. The expression of it can vary. So let's look at the early Methodists at worship. Wesley was adamant that the early Methodist Church was not a new denomination. It was a society of devout people, a religious society within the established church. The Church of England in England, the Church of Ireland in Ireland. They were sister churches. And he always belonged to the Church of England himself. And he hoped that his Methodist people always would. So how did this worshipping, this society of enthusiasts worship within the established church? And on Sunday, the Methodists were expected to go to their preaching house and to the parish church, to both. Wesley called his buildings preaching houses because the word church or the word chapel was used by the Church of England. A church for the building that served the parish, a chapel for a building related to an institution. So, no, not church or chapel. The word meeting house was used for Presbyterians and other nonconformists, and Wesley didn't want to be thought of as a nonconformist. So Methodist buildings were called preaching houses. In about the middle of the 19th century, they began to call them chapels, and they are still chapels in England and Wales. But the Irish began to get affluent in the later years of the 19th century and to put pinnacles and all sorts of things on the decoration of their buildings, and they began to call them churches, because after all, we're as good as the Church of Ireland, aren't we? To come back to what went on in the preaching houses, Wesley wanted his people to go and worship there before they went to the parish church. And the ideal hour, as far as he could see, was 5 o'clock in the morning. You would enjoy that, wouldn't you? Come to think of it, for many people it would have been the ideal hour, because they could go there before they started work. If they were working class people, if they were tradespeople, if they were servants, they would probably have to start work for the day at 6 or 6:30. So 5 was an ideal time to go. But I don't think that everybody followed that. And certainly in the country, they probably did not. The parish church would have its matins or morning prayer, I think in most places about 11, but it varied. And Wesley is absolutely scathing about one parish church in the west of Ireland where morning service was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon because the ladies of fashion could not huddle into their clothes fit to be seen before that hour. I'm quoting him almost verbatim. Now, in the Methodist preaching house, they had a service that encouraged enthusiasm and commitment, encouraged them to take faith seriously and live it. And in the parish church, they had the traditional liturgical service, and Wesley saw these two as a balanced diet of worship. It's very hard to know what an early Methodist meeting was like, because the only records we have are of people who had conversion experiences in them. Nobody else bothered to take any note of what went on. And the trouble was that once you had a religious experience in the middle of the sermon, you were so excited and so thrilled that you took notice of nothing else around you. So what went on after the sermon, we are not terribly sure. But we know that the meeting would begin with a hymn. A hymn by Charles Wesley. When eventually the Methodists published their first collection of hymns in 1780, it contained 515 hymns, almost all written by Charles Wesley. A few were written by John, and in some cases there is a dispute as to which wrote which. But the hymn would start, and in areas of illiteracy, and there were quite a number of them in the 18th century, if you had a number of illiterate people in the church, you gave the hymn out line by line. The preacher announced the line, the congregation sang it, the preacher announced the second line, the congregation sang it, and so on. It took quite a long time to get through that. Thank heaven, as more and more people learned to read, it was possible for them to use leaflets and eventually hymn books. There would be a hymn, there would be a prayer, and there would be a short reading from Holy Scripture, all of which could be contained within 15 minutes. Wesley advised his preachers not to keep the people for more than an hour. But that still left a good 40 minutes for the sermon. And that was the main object of the gathering. It was an exhortation to the people, an exposition of Scripture, and an exhortation to them for their daily living. And nobody thought twice about sitting through 40 minutes of it. Probably. At the close, they may have sung another hymn, and there would have been a prayer. So the balanced diet of Sunday was that meeting to encourage them and enthuse them, and then the liturgy to remind them of the majesty and the magnificence of God in the superb language of the 1662 prayer book. When we moved out of the Anglican fold, and the Irish were the last to do it, it wasn't until 1816 that we began the move to be a denomination of our own. It then became necessary to change the pattern. You had to do more than listen to a sermon for 40 minutes. Somewhere or other, you had to include prayers, not only for yourselves, but for other people, for particular needs, for the world. if your mind could stretch that far, and in the 18th century it may not have done all that much. So you had to extend your service in some way to cater for all the aspects of faith in relation to life, and what we call the hymn sandwich in evolved. Came the 19th century, the American evangelists, people like Moody and Sankey, came over to these islands and preached evangelical missions throughout the British Isles, and began to publish hymns to be used in these services. They became the tunes that were known to many people as Methodist tunes, though they weren't actually Methodist. They were the tunes the Methodists sang when they sat at the parlor piano on Sunday evening, and the family gathered round and sang things by Francis Van Alstyne and writers like that. The early Methodists and the Methodists in church at that time continued to sing Charles Wesley. Now, the great advantage of Charles Wesley is that his hymns are so saturated in Scripture. Scholars have counted no less than 4 scriptural allusions in each 4-line verse of some hymns. And that was the way the Methodists learned their faith. Think back. What do you remember of your school days? Do you remember what teacher said? Do you remember what you wrote in your homework? Do you remember the songs you sang in the playground? Songs are the things that people remember. Music helps us to remember. And the early Methodists learned their theology by singing Charles Wesley, so that his hymns not only broke up the tedium of a voice all through the hour, but taught them what they believed, and they could sing about it at home, and they could sing about it on the street. But there was not only Sunday. There were also weekday meetings. Methodist societies, and the term for a Methodist group of people worshipping in one place, for instance in Dunleary, is still technically a society. Congregation is the word used by other denominations, but technically we speak of a society, a Methodist society in Dunleary, a Methodist society in Bray. The members of the Methodist societies were broken into classes, and classes could be quite large. I have counted more than 30 members of a class in the Methodist circuit in Dublin in 1784. And some of these classes were for women, some were for men, some were for both. And you'd find husband and wife in the same class, which was very convenient, perhaps, for meeting. And the class leader, oh, by the way, there were special classes for young people. The class leader who conducted the classes, if the class was limited to women, might possibly be a lady. If it was for men, it was certainly a man, and it was also a man if it was a mixed class, because they hadn't quite accepted the idea that women could teach men. That was to come later. But the job of these men and women who were class leaders was to conduct a meeting of their class regularly. There were so many classes in Dublin that I don't think they could all have met weekly. I think they must have met monthly. but was to conduct a class meeting regularly to encourage all those present in their Christian faith and to exhort them to greater effort, to greater understanding, and to greater witness. They were exhorting, they were not preaching. Now, if you can tell me where exhorting ends and preaching begins, I'd be grateful, because I'm not terribly sure. But in my own mind, a woman conducting a class meeting was as much a local preacher as somebody who was conducting the worship on Sunday in the preaching house, except that her local preaching was to her class rather than to a widely varied group. The classes lasted until near the end of the 19th century, and in some places they were still meeting up to the 1950s. But really, they began to disappear when the church began to have specialized groups to deal with specialized people. You had, for instance, special meetings for the young, Sunday school, Christian Endeavor, Boys Brigade with its Bible class, Girls Brigade with that Bible class, things that catered for the religious development of boys and girls, either together or apart. And perhaps there wasn't any further need for a class for young people. You also found at the end of the 19th century a development of an organization for women, fully known as the Women's Department of the Methodist Missionary Society. But nobody ever bothered about the of the Methodist Missionary Society. Its interests were very much in overseas missions. But the Women's Department, or the WD as we called it, took an interest in women's activities generally. And that catered for women, and perhaps was one of the reasons that contributed to the fading of the class meeting. Curiously enough, there was no men's equivalent. A layman's fellowship didn't develop until the 1950s, and that in turn has given way to the lay witness movement, which is, of course, both men and women. So you will see that the Methodists of the early years did have a regular meeting to encourage them in their faith and to encourage them in their practice of that faith. They also had band meetings. Now, class meetings, as I say, could have had as many as 50 people in one class. It was virtually like a service. The band meetings were very specialist and very, very seldom more than 7 people in any one. And they were people with similar situations. You kept the men and the women apart. 7 men or 7 women. 7 young men and 7 old men. 7 men in the middle. You separated the married from the single. So if you had a band of women, in one case it might be a band of widows, in another a band of wives, in another a band of single ladies. I hesitate to use the word spinster, though I think that's the one they would have used at that stage. And these bands were there to encourage people in their Christian lives. They were one of the means by which Wesley encouraged the development of holiness. When you went to the society, to the band meeting, you of course shared with the band in the successes that from time to time came your way, an answer to prayer, a temptation overcome, or something that had happened to you that had made you deeply conscious of the life of God in the society. And you also confessed your failures. You also told them what you did during the last week, which you were ashamed about. And some people have been horrified at the thought that folk were expected to tell others what they had done. But remember, it was only seven people, and they were supposed to be completely confidential. They were not supposed to repeat out of band what they had heard in band. And I have always felt that there was another aspect of the band meeting, and that was its preventive side. If I knew that next Tuesday I was going to have to tell my band that on Saturday evening I got blind drunk and beat the daylights out of the wife, that was a very good deterrent to actually doing it. If you know that what you are going to do is going to come out somewhere, and it's nasty, you'll be slower to do it. And I think we've largely overlooked that aspect of the life of the bands. Now, in order to be a Methodist, you had to be a member of class. If you didn't attend your class, then you were put out of membership. You were neglecting one of the duties of a member. But the bands were different. And there is no certainty that all the members of the society were in bands. Many of them would not have been. This was for people who really took their faith seriously. There were select bands for those who had made some progress on the route, but they were very few, and I think were prone to the sin of pride that we got a little bit further than others along the road to holiness. The bands lasted rather longer than the select bands, but they didn't last as long as the class meetings. They began to fail, I think, very early in the 19th century. I may be wrong on that. So that was the Methodist worship and practice during every day, during every week, during every month. This was what kept their enthusiasm. This is what fed them in the faith. And this is what made them what they were. The administration of the Methodist Church, or the Methodist societies, using whichever phrase happens to be relevant for the period, has always been very interesting in one respect. And that is that in almost every official administrative meeting, the laity are vastly in the majority. One tends to think of churches as being dictated by the clergy. There are some clergy, I think we have to admit, who have tried to dictate, but it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because always we have had leaders' meetings, quarterly meetings, councils, executives, synods, where the majority of those attending, the majority of those debating, the majority of those voting, if they have a vote, are lay people, so that you can never be sure that the laity won't outvote what the ministers are trying to do, or what the ministers want to do. In fact, one of the interesting things about administration in Methodism is that while many people have influence, nobody has power. Not according to the Constitution. Sometimes works out that some people can impose their will on others. But not even the president of the conference has power. The moment when it comes nearest to that is when there is an emergency in a circuit. A minister has died, a minister has taken ill, a minister can no longer carry out his duties. Somebody has to supply. It's the president who appoints somebody to follow him. But the president can't do that on his own. He has to call his president's advisory committee. And the advisory committee will suggest to him the name to propose. He may debate that. He may indeed, up to a point, refuse their advice. But he cannot propose a name himself over what they have told to him. If he doesn't like the first suggestion they make, they must find another one. And that series of checks and balances in our Methodist system have been tremendously admired by people in other denominations and by people in other walks of life. We are, in a way, one of the very democratic Christian bodies. So much for administration. Now let's come to social concerns. I debated whether I should put the comment I'm going to make now under worship, but I decided no, social concern was probably the better place for it. Because one of the features of early Methodism, one of the remarkable features of early Methodism, was the way it encouraged sobriety and industry in its members. If you became a member of a Methodist society, two of the things you were committed to, in actual practical terms, apart altogether from religious observance, were sobriety and industry. Wesley expected his people to make a contribution to human life, not to be takers, but to be givers, not to be dependent, but to be people who could be depended upon. And to that end, sobriety was important. If you got drunk every other day, you were not going to do much in the way of work, you were not going to earn very much, you were going to be useless to society. That wasn't what Wesley saw as the ideal of humanity. And so he encouraged sobriety. And that was one of the marks of early Methodism. Not total abstinence. Wesley believed that the ideal drink was home-brewed ale. He thought it was the ideal drink for people. Do remember that when Wesley was alive, it was almost fatal to drink water. We're so used to turning a tap and drinking what comes out, that we forget that in many places that just was not possible. Even your own well could be polluted under certain circumstances. And certainly public water supplies were in a very poor state. So, home-brewed ale as the ideal cheap drink for most people. He also said that wine was the noblest cordial known to man. But I don't think he was terribly worried about it because it was an expensive procedure and it was largely confined to the wealthy. Ale was more likely to be the drink of the working classes. He disliked people drinking tea. That wasn't the tea was poisonous. It was simply that in his day, tea was hideously expensive, and he thought people should not waste money on it. That was for wealthy millionaires who had it to spend. And he was afraid that people spend far too much time wasting time drinking tea. Samuel Johnson objected to Mr. Wesley. He would never fold his legs and have his conversation out. He always had to be up and doing. There were more important things to do. And that was his large objection to tea. So you see, sobriety meant drinking probably ale, which was quite economic, and you drank with a meal or whatever. He did frown on spirits, because it was on spirits that people got really drunk. And he discouraged the drinking of spirits. But he was all in favor of sobriety. One of the things that the total abstinence lobby has done in recent years is to conceal the difference between temperance and total abstinence. Temperance is not total abstinence. Temperance is modest, responsible use. Total abstinence is total refusal. And total abstinence came into Irish Methodism in the fourth quarter of the 19th century under the influence of the American evangelists who were preaching around at that time. It has become very associated with Methodism because Methodism is evangelical. But it also affected the evangelical wings of the Church of Ireland, the Presbyterian Church, the Congregationals, and others. You will find that most evangelicals, even to this day, are total abstainers. Now, if you were sober, you could then earn money. And you could then be responsible. You would not be a drag on society. You could contribute to society. You could do something useful. You could work hard. And he actually preached a sermon on the use of money. The three points of his sermon are classic. Point number one, earn all you can. Good, hard work, earn all you can. And the assumption is that you will earn it honestly. I think Mr. Wesley took that for granted. Nowadays, I wouldn't be quite so certain. The second heading, save all you can. Don't waste money on fripperies. Don't waste money on frills and furbelows and things that are unnecessary. The Methodists in the 18th and 19th century were nearly as simply dressed as the Quakers. They didn't go in for fussy clothes. They didn't go in for fancy things and elaborate decoration. They dressed plainly, dressed well, but neat and neatly, but not extravagantly. Save all you can. And in her book on the Guinness family, Michelle Guinness makes the point that that was a great recipe for wealth. But she's quite forgotten that there was a third point that Mr. Wesley made. Give all you can. Now, obviously, he was thinking that you would give to the work of the Methodist community. But his thought would go much further than that. That you would give to wherever there was need. And if you gave all you could, you didn't get wealthy. You were able to live. You were able to live comfortably, perhaps. But you didn't get wealthy. trouble is most people forgot the third instruction. And a number of Methodists did become quite wealthy. Classic examples, perhaps, are Ranks of the Flour Industry and McIntosh's Toffee, which started with Mrs. McIntosh boiling toffee in her little kitchen in Huddersfield and developed into a nationwide industry. But Wesley's point remains industry, sobriety, industry, and I think we might add, generosity. He himself claimed to live on £20 a year all his life. That, of course, was in the 18th century. One has to allow that for half the year, in every other year, he was travelling around Ireland at probably no cost to himself, because he was staying in the homes of members of the society. And one also has to remember that in that age, money did a lot more than it does today. So the first emphasis on Methodism, the first way in which Methodism was seen as making a contribution to society, was by their sobriety and their industry. But they reached out into society in other ways. The early Methodist preachers were regular prison visitors. They went to the prisons to talk to the prisoners. Now, remember, in those days you could be imprisoned for debt. And you stayed in prison until the debt was paid, whether it was paid next week or 10 years hence. And one of the things which they did, in fact, was to help by paying part of the debts of the prisoners, helping them to get out as soon as possible. They also visited the prisoners in a hope to encourage them and reform them, and they visited prisoners under sentence of death to prepare them to meet their maker. And there are instances of last-minute conversions in the prisons as a result. So prison visitation was an early activity, which later we dropped because the prisons organized it, and you now have to be organized as a prison visitor. A distant cousin of mine regularly goes to prison in London as a prison visitor, not as a prisoner. One of the early things that Wesley did was to establish widows' almshouses, because the widows were the most defenseless people in the society of his day. The only almshouse he was involved in Ireland was the one in Whitefriar Street, the Methodist Widows' Home, which had originally 20 women housed in 10 rooms in a large house, with two more rooms reserved for the use of the lady in charge. They then decided not to keep a lady in charge so that they could take in four more women, two to each room, and the maid who did the cleaning slept under the stairs. I mean, you've got to get things into proportion, haven't you? Now, that widow's almshouse in Whitefriar Street had to be closed when the lease was expiring in the middle of the 19th century. So they started looking round for somewhere else, and they moved to Grantham Street. And you can still see the building in Grantham Street where these ladies were housed, two to a room. From there, they went out to near Portobello in a house where they were housed, one to each room. And then the house which Mooney of Johnson, Mooney and O'Brien had built for himself on Palmerston Park came on the market. And so the Methodist Widow's Home moved to Palmerston Park. And because the house was called Eastwell, it is now known as Eastwell Retirement Home. But it has been flourishing since 1764. One of Wesley's concerns shared by his Dublin Methodists. It was only in recent years that the Central Missions and one other congregation in Ireland have gone seriously into the business of sheltered housing for the elderly. One of the fascinating things about early Methodist circuits is that practically every one of them had at least one elementary school. It was not hard to house. In the Methodist preaching house, people sat on backless benches. You couldn't lean back in the pew. There wasn't a pew. You sat on a backless bench. You sat upright. And if at any stage you began to sag, whoever was behind you woke you up again. It was quite easy to rearrange benches like that to form classes for the small children. It was elementary education. I don't suppose it lasted beyond their 12th year. Children tended to begin work at 13 in those days. But one of the fascinating things is the reference to the little primary school, little elementary school run by the Methodists in Lawrencetown. You all know Lawrencetown, don't you? Hands up who's been to Lawrencetown. I thought it might be that. Lawrencetown is a tiny little village in County Galway that you don't normally pass through when you're going from anywhere to anywhere. And it had a small Methodist chapel at one stage. And one year they actually recorded 100 children or more in this tiny school. There weren't enough Methodists to provide 100 children. And I think that was true wherever you went. The people were eager to be educated. And so, Catholic, Protestant, Presbyterian, Methodist, whatever. If the Methodist school happened to be available, they would go. And all they were taught were the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, to which I should probably add a fourth R, religion. I'm quite sure that there was biblical teaching given as well. Now, these schools eventually disappeared for economic reasons when schools were amalgamated in different areas by the Board of Education. But we did make education a priority in our early thinking as Methodist people. The only Methodist primary school that survives in Ireland at the moment is the one on Rathgar Avenue, which has always catered for other faiths. In fact, one of my near neighbours in Altenor was educated there in her early girlhood. Education, the care of the elderly. Adam Clark, one of Wesley's lieutenants, a remarkable man from County Antrim, had the bright idea of establishing a Strangers' Friend Society in Bristol and then in other places, including one in Dublin. How many of you remember the Strangers' Friend Society? Yes. The Strangers' Friend Society was a group of Methodists who met regularly and received appeals for help from people in dire need. They asked that the request would always be supported by the pastor of their own church, be it the parish priest, the rector, the curate, the Presbyterian minister, the Methodist minister, as long as there was a ministerial signature. And the visitors then went out, visited the places, visited the houses, and offered a small amount of help. And it was surprising what a small amount of help could do. Wesley Ludlow, who was a very prominent member of our Rathgar church, told me that on one occasion a little woman who sold oranges from a basket on wheels somewhere in the region of O'Connell Street took ill. And the cost of her treatment, she had to sell her basket. And her basket was her life. And when she came out of hospital, she had nothing. Nothing except the clothes she lived in, she wore, and the accommodation where she could sleep. And she applied to the Strangers' Friend Society. And they gave her £10. £5 in those days bought her another basket. The other £5 bought her a stock of oranges, and she was back in business. I mean, this was the sort of thing that the Strangers' Friend Society did. It wasn't a tremendous fund, but it was a sort of fund that people could appeal to when they were in dire necessity and when a little help would go a long way. But the Strangers' Friend Society eventually threw in its lot with the Dublin Central Mission. The work of the church never stopped reaching out into the community in some way or another. And probably the most important impact we have made on communities in Ireland was through the establishment at the end of the 19th century of the City Missions, which simply recognized that there were hundreds of people in every city who would never go near church. They didn't have nice clothes to wear on Sunday. And they were a little overawed by the architecture of the churches. So they had the idea of building a hall, providing tip-up comfortable seats, a platform instead of a pulpit, and a lively service that would welcome these good folk. The working classes, we used to call them. Not sure that it is a good title, but it implies that everybody else was idle. But these good people would come into the mission and find a place, a care, and not only a place of worship and a faith, but a place of social communication and care, where somebody would take an interest in them. Now, I think the idea was that eventually the families would move on to other churches. You see, that the mission would feed the better churches in the area. Don't think they did, because there is a thing called gratitude. And a lot of those who were helped by the missions remained loyal to the missions for the rest of their lives. It was a good expression of gratitude that they simply stayed where they had been first helped. And that is what I mean by practicing the faith. Some people have said to me, the trouble is that in Dublin, we leave the practice of our faith to the missions. I'm not sure. First of all, I think the support that the congregations, the circuits, give to the mission is an act of goodness, an act of charity, an act of responsibility. And as well as that, I know that over recent years, in one way or another, Methodist congregations have found all sorts of fascinating ways of relating to the need of the people around. So that faith is not only thought, faith is not only sung about, faith is not only prayed, it is practiced.